IVM. Hello, hello, we're Team Splainer. Welcome to an all-new episode of Press Decode, a weekly podcast where we take Splainer's mission to declutter the news one step further. Check out our newsletter for more stories. We've got a one-month free trial for you in the show notes, so don't forget to take us for a free spin. But for now, just sit back, relax, and don't let the news give you the blues. I'm Vagda, your host for the day, and I have with me Sara and Prafulla. As always, we have three segments for you. In our first segment, we're talking about the dreaded Indian competitive exams and their unreasonable rules in the context of candidates being asked to remove their bras before entering the medical entrance exam hall. For the food for thought segment, we're looking at the racist side of wildlife conservation. And in our final segment, we'll be roasting and toasting our fave and least fave items. So let's get on with the big story. Last Sunday, the big bad medical entrance exam took place, the National Eligibility Cum Entrance Test, NEET, for undergraduates. And as with all exams, there are some rules as to how it is conducted, which involve what you can do and what you can take in the exam hall, most in order to prevent cheating. The national testing agency that conducts the exam has rules that you can't wear metal objects, huge buttons, dark clothes with full sleeves, and many more seemingly ridiculous conditions for entry. So last Sunday, when about 15 lakh students appeared for this exam, many in Kollam district in Kerala were not allowed inside because they wore bras that had metal hooks. Now, most bras have metal hooks. So women entering the exam hall were asked if their bras had metal hooks. And if yes, they were made to queue up separately, where they were asked to enter a room and remove their bras. Some accounts of students say the innerwear were just lying on the ground mixed up with others, while some say that they were all put in a box with no COVID protocol. Now, candidates felt overwhelmed, obviously, and their parents complained that the rules did not mention anything about innerwear and that the rules were actually intended to address metallic buckles and belts and stuff. I mean, can you imagine? It's just student activists obviously then came out in protest and vandalized the exam center. This is on Monday after the exam. The police then registered a complaint and five people were arrested. Three of the NTA, that's the National Testing Agency, and two of that particular exam center on charges of outraging modesty. So that's all about what happened. And what do you know? It's not the first time at all. This is routine. Every year it's the same complaint with NEET, which makes you think, how have authorities not dealt with this already? I mean, you couldn't possibly think a bra is a security concern. We're producing some Charlie's Angels in order to crack the NEET exam.
I mean, just, considering the NEET, I get it. But no.
Still, it's like, it's so ridiculous. And I just have nothing else to say other than outrage. But I'm thinking, like, if you think about competitive exams and you try to look at the bigger picture, we store our exam question papers under lock and key in the police station. Like, it's some evidence. What is this? But they are still leaked to social media. And so then what do? We turn to even more sophisticated and stringent measures like internet jammers near centers, CCTV cameras in exam halls. In 2019, a school in Karnataka forced students to wear cardboard boxes over their heads to prevent cheating.
It's a priceless image though.
Yeah. But I'm just thinking, does this happen across the world? Doesn't the world like conduct exams? How do they do it? Is cheating in exams an Indian thing? I mean, I understand because we have like crazy competition. But what is the deal with cheating? We have like internet shutdown because of cheating. I don't know. What is the deal with it?
I don't know. I think, see, from what I've gathered, this isn't an India-only problem, but it is definitely way more widespread here than anywhere across the world that I've read about. And obviously, cheating will make headlines if it is large scale, not in isolated centers, let alone somebody, you know, helping out a friend with a couple of answers.
This is a good time to ask. Have you guys cheated in exams? Just fascinated.
No, man. Interesting. I am not sneaky, like, at all in life. Even if I try, I can't. That person that you'll be able to see who's overcompensating with all kinds of shit because they did something sneaky.
Yeah, I'm the person who would be helping a friend, mostly because of, you ask somebody enough times in an exam, dikha de yaar, they will get annoyed and show you the answer. So that was me.
Damn, you were the dikha de yaar.
You were cheating.
No. The one showing the...
I've been dikha de yaar and ye lo dekh lo. Dono. I've done both. Depending on subject and day. But interesting. Very interesting.
You know, we shouldn't probably give our own examples. But thinking of Sunday's NEET, there's been so many complaints and, you know, reports of arrests have also come out from the exam. Like 8 people have been arrested in connection with the cheating racket. And these people apparently morphed candidates' pictures on their admit card to allow someone else to take their place and then write the exam for them. So,
Munna bhai.
I know. That movie really was ahead of its time. But even if we do take a step back just from the NEET, I've seen plenty of exams get leaked online. And I've realized recently that it has gotten much bigger than what it used to be when I was in school.
Dude, this actually reminds me. So I finished like 12th grade in 2017. And 2018, the economics paper board exam, CBSE, was like leaked. So like it was so full-fledgedly leaked. They had to redo the exam a month later.
I remember that.
And when I tell you, I thanked all my stars and more that I wasn't that batch. Because I can't possibly imagine redoing a board exam.
Let alone economics.
I swear.
No, but you know, I was thinking about how WhatsApp kind of came in and became big when I was in high school. And if you got a paper, it used to be like a big deal. And like, you had to be like hush hush about it. But more recently, like Sarah said, in 2018, the economics paper. And if I recall correctly, the 2020 batch had, I think, their business studies paper or something cancelled entirely because just that many people had actually seen the different variations of the question paper. But you know, all this is not to say that we don't have unreasonable rules. A lot of them are downright ridiculous. But look at the flip side, no? The technology that is now available to us, coupled with these networks that have emerged that help people hack their way through their exams, have made it a nightmare, not just for, say, the testing agency, but also for students who are taking these exams, right? And just last year, during the teacher's entrance exam, some candidates bought Bluetooth slippers and they paid like 5 lakhs or something for to be able to cheat in the exam hall.
Bluetooth slippers.
Someone also put like flesh colored Bluetooth earphones into their ears so they wouldn't get caught and whatnot. Like they got it specially made.
Wow. I mean, all I want to say is if you put in that much energy towards cheating, if you put that into your exam. But I think the problem is now we have this extensive knowledge and the tools with which to cheat. And on top of that, we have this pressure that has been created around exams, which I think also allows these rules to come into force. Like when the Rajasthan government last year justified the internet shutdown, they said that the candidates applying for government posts were applying for government posts and that cheating in such an exam would be, quote unquote, a betrayal of the exam and the state. And, you know, it's also a thing about people's livelihoods at one point. So putting all that together, I see why these ridiculous rules exist. But whether or not standardized testing and all these rules that we have to bring in with it work is a different discussion altogether. There is obviously so much more in the system that we have right now, more than meets the eye, that both encourages cheating and in turn requires us to then enforce as many rules as we now do have to.
Yeah, I think both sides, right? Like when Wagda was speaking, it does sound ridiculous as the candidate. On the other hand, even when it comes to enforcement, it's that meme, kare to kare kya? So, but I'm going to start with the most, like, for some reason, I had a lot of fun reading about cheating and the way and ways and means in which this happens in this country because it's genius sometimes. But for some trivia, turns out the first recorded accusation of cheating in exams in India dates back to, any guesses of like a year? Come on. 1892.
What? What exams are these?
I will set the whole story up for you. So basically, court records show that a student called Rakhal Das Ghosh was taking the University of Calcutta entrance exam and decided to forge the headmaster's signature on his application. Records showed that the supervisor knew that it was a forged signature, but still allowed him to take the exam. He was later charged with cheating, but then judges cleared him of any wrongdoing, saying that all he wanted to do was actually just write the damn exam. Unfortunately, I found this like this anecdote on Financial Times, and they could not really find out whether or not Ghosh made it to the university or not. But I get why he wasn't penalized. Yeah, bichara, he just wanted to write the exam. So whatever. But that was the apparently first recorded incident of academic cheating. But moving on, right? Like Prafulla briefly hinted, the system is broken. Like, cheating is currently a whole industry in this country. Like, the headlines that we're reading aren't your, acha, tell me the answer, you'll see one answer. It is these large-scale incidents. Like, I think it was Bihar. I don't remember. I think it's 2014, 15. Remember when there was that image of, like, people scaling the walls of this school and telling, giving answers out? Have you all seen this image?
I don't remember this.
I will link it. It is insane. So basically, it's like a school and you can see like friends and family have scaled the wall up to the first, second, third floor just to tell answers.
Wow.
It became the lead image for so many headlines. Because again, insane image. But that's the thing, right? Like the headlines that come out of the country are outrageous and crazy. And that's when I realized it's an entire, like, as a lot of media now deems it, cheating mafia that's in play. But that's also then emblematic of like a larger problem, right? Like, no points for guessing. The most basic problem with our examinations that we've all dealt with is rote learning, when most of our exams are only about memorizing and regurgitating. So in a system like that, honestly, how much can you memorize? So cheating becomes the easiest way to get out of it. So the system itself isn't really conducive to learning or actually giving these exams authentically, so to say. But then that's very obvious. The other thing that I was actually more intrigued to read about was that basically the country has seen rapid development in the last couple years, which means that there have been crazy aspirations for like social mobility. And like everyone basically wants a pie of the wealth that's available in cities and whatnot. And a way to get there is to like secure seats in good universities. But then for that, you have to nail these exams. And like we know, we have way too many applicants for way too many seats. Like, to put this into numbers, I read that the annual admission rate at IITs is less than 2%, where almost 500,000 people apply every year, which is insane, right? And it's all people from the country, for the most part. And like, beyond this, that's when you come to realize, right, the stakes are so high with these exams, because you're not talking about like social mobility, making a better life for yourself and whatnot. So, and it's in a system that doesn't really require you to study. So then you want to just nail this one exam, because everything is, it isn't about the year you spent. It is about that one exam. It all boils down to that. So by hook or crook, you just want to get there. And then that's when like the ethics don't really matter to you. A clear example of this, like I saw, was in 2018. Apparently UP has like a crazy, crazy problem with cheating. So they decided in 2018 to crack down very heavily. And so they installed CCTV cameras and deployed police forces at exam centers during annual exams. And guess what the result was? Nearly 500,000 students did not show up because they knew they wouldn't be able to cheat.
Whoa.
Which is 10% of the people supposed to be taking the exam.
Wow.
Because that's the thing, right? It is about the end result that comes out of it. If you know you're not going to get there, they were just like, oh, why bother? Mm. And to make it like worse, sad, better, I don't even know at this point. Teachers in this country, like we all know, are grossly underpaid. So it's almost like incentivized for them to abet this cheating, because they can be bribed. And moreover, like, our education system really like values pass percentages, pass rates. Like, I remember in school after 10th grade, getting that, like, how many people got that quintessential 10 CGPA made a life of difference for the school. And that also meant that the teachers do well. So the teachers will also abet this, because that means that their records show well. So I think like the bottom line is, it isn't just about students being like getting a bad end of this by facing outrageous rules like, oh, remove your bra, or like on the other hand, you see these crazy incidents of like genius almost and then like law enforcement doesn't know what to do either. It is the larger problem is our education system, and that needs to be overhauled. And clearly we're not moving in that direction, come what may, because we've decided to embrace the CUET, which is the common entrance exam, which places more importance on a single exam than anything else.
Yep.
So I will actually link our like Splainer big story about this specific exam because I don't want to get into it. But clearly the problem is deeper than just incidents of cheating.
True. Okay, on that note, we come to the end of our first segment. We'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to Press Decode on the IVM Podcasts Network. Hello and welcome back to Press Decode on the IVM Podcasts Network. We're Team Splainer, and in today's Food for Thought, we're looking at wildlife conservation again. But this time, it's racist side. About a week ago, this movie called Where the Crawdads Sing was released. It's based on a novel by Delia Owens, who was a wildlife conservationist in Africa for about two decades between 1970s and the 1990s. Okay, I'm gonna give you some spoilers because I'm talking about the plot of the book and the movie, so please be forewarned. The plot is basically, it's a story of a young woman who survives in the wilderness, isolated from humans, which is all weaved around the murder of a man. But it brought back Owen's career as a conservationist in Africa back in the public eye, and many saw eerie parallels between its plot and a killing in Zambia. This killing was captured on screen by an ABC News TV crew, which followed Owen's in 1994-95 for a news magazine show called Turning Point. The show in essence tried to capture the increasingly violent confrontation between the poachers and Owens, who are framed as an idealistic American couple, young in love and dedicated to saving animals. But you can see footage of the alleged poacher getting shot in that video, in the show. Zambian authorities are convinced that the man was shot by Delia's stepson. Her husband dumped the body in a lagoon, making it near impossible to gather evidence. And even though Zambian authorities want to press charges, Owens are still safe in America because they don't have an extradition treaty between the two countries. Now, the case shone light on how racism plays out in wildlife conservation. Owens actually built a militia of scouts who were supposed to take down poachers. They literally armed civilians to shoot and kill poachers as if creating their own law enforcement. So humans are expendable for conserving animals? Or is it some humans? And more specifically, anybody other than the white man? Early arguments in favor of conserving wildlife are based on this particular idea that to preserve nature, we need to create habitats free of the polluting human presence. And so it became like this in African conservation parks that, I'm quoting here, the pecking order outside the parks was white settler, indigenous black African, and wild animal. The pecking order inside the parks, the conservation parks, was tourist, animal, and indigenous black. End quote. Wow. So it came down to European colonists applying the same relocation and control technologies that they would apply to the animal world to black populations in Africa. That is really where we start in terms of wildlife conservation in Africa.
You know, the unfortunate thing is here that it just doesn't stop with Delia Owens or colonists from the last century, because this white savior complex is still very real and thriving, especially in Africa. A thought that I had while, you know, we were going over this was that it has to stem from some sort of like white supremacist, white savior complex, right? And when we were reading up for our big story, there's two things that struck me in particular. One is the use of so-called conservation armies. So these are either personnel from the national military who the government then stations at national parks or sanctuaries. These people are either stationed there or they provide park rangers with training to take down poachers. Other times, countries and individual parks will contract private ranger contingents and in some cases, even UN peacekeeping forces to protect animals in the area. But here's the problem with this, right? Rangers trained with military precision can be very dangerous, especially if they're allowed to shoot on sight, which is, I think, the case in Cameroon or someplace. There's been several reports of local villagers being shot when they've gone into the parks to collect their herds or scavenge for, say, bamboo or other material. In some cases, these ranger contingents or, you know, the army personnel have sort of even been involved in the relocation of these villagers. Forceful relocation, obviously. And the second thing is NGOs. It might come as a surprise because it was a surprise to me, but certain conservation groups and NGOs are way more deeply involved in this whole mess than we could ever imagine. Reports have shown, for example, that agents sanctioned by the WWF basically pillaged entire villages of an indigenous tribe that's called the Baka. In another case, there's NGOs that maintain some of these national parks, but they're founded in the West, obviously by people who are wealthy and white. And then these organizations turn these parks into luxury lodges and they cater, take a guess, to more wealthy and white people. And in order to maintain these parks, these NGOs will have these really stringent rules about poaching. But the irony is they will go ahead and encourage hunting tourism, which is offered as an experience to their guests. So the same thing that they're killing the locals for, they're allowing their guests to take as trophies. And, you know, there was this one ranger contingent that was stationed in Tanzania, and the American weapons trainer there in an interview said, "We are going to the national parks to do some good and to kill some bad guys." So that comment resulted in their group being blacklisted from the country. But I think it very well sums up this whole neo-colonial mindset that, you know, nature has to be protected from the black man.
Wow. Yeah. Mm. But in case you guys felt like you soothed your conscience a little bit by thinking this is just the white man, allow me to break the bubble. As always, I am the bearer of grim and grim news. The situation is not very different in India. I'll take the case study of Kaziranga because it caused a lot of furor back in 2017 and explain why. But for some context, one of our most prime wildlife sanctuaries is Kaziranga National Park, which is in Assam, and it is home to the Indian one-horned rhinoceros, and like, might I add, it houses two-thirds of the total world's population of the rhino. So now, but the thing is, this park is not special only for that. It is also infamous for like how heavily armed the park rangers are, much like what you described in like sanctuaries in Africa. Mm. So here too, the rangers have the power to shoot at will. Sure, there are caveats, like you need to, if you cannot ensure that you understand the identity of the person. But like you said, when it comes to armed conflict, very little of rules are followed when you have the impunity to shoot at will. Statistics show that at one point, the rangers in Kaziranga were killing around 2 people every month. And in the year 2015, the situation was so bleak that more people were killed in the park than rhinos. So the instructions are actually very, very simple. Whenever you see the poachers or hunters, we start our guns and hunt them. Yeah, yeah, fully ordered to shoot them. Whenever you see the poachers or any people during nighttime, we are ordered to shoot them. And this is a park ranger. Now, might I also add, our angst shouldn't be directed at the park ranger because clearly, like they're saying, these are just instructions that have been handed down to them.
Hmm.
But the problem now with these rules and very ill thought out rules is a lot of the people who get killed aren't poachers, but innocent tribal villagers who live nearby. There are cases like of children being shot in ways that have rendered them disabled for the rest of their lives. And for what? For just crossing like a little border that's not even carefully demarcated between like where their populations, like human population lives versus where the national park starts. And I think the most interesting thing that I saw, so basically a lot of this came to light in India about Kaziranga when the BBC did a 2017 report, which is where the controversy happened, but I'll get to that in a bit. But an observation that was made in that is a lot of India's crazy conservation policies, and I later realized even across the world, are only about protecting a few emblematic species. Like, there is high stakes patriotism then that comes into this conservation, as comes with everything else in this country. So think rhinos and tigers in specific, okay? There's so much political will and pressure. So as like more than even the motivations simply to just save populations of these animals. And that's when you get to these rules that are not really well thought out. And similarly, I think I was even reading about like the roots of white racism, white versus black racism in like Africa. The first few conservationists who decided to do this as a hobby were like, actually decided, oh, because as humans, we now have the power and responsibility to serve certain species. Make of that what you will. Wow. So it's clearly some people and, you know, some animals that are more important than others. So back to that BBC story, I was very, very intrigued because I first only chanced upon their big, long report, which I am going to link. It's a very, very good read. But when it came out, it was considered so offensive and one-sided by the government that the BBC was not allowed to shoot in the country's national park for a five-year period. So I assume sometime now it should be ending. The government claims that, you know, the organization eventually realized their mistakes and apologized. But the BBC continues to maintain that they stand by this report of, like, basically they called it extrajudicial killings in the park. So, but like pointed out, like, even the poachers aren't not armed, okay? Like, in Kaziranga specifically, because I've read these reports, they have all sorts of weapons. So I'm not saying the park rangers should just stand with no arms whatsoever. I mean, yes, there needs to be a balanced view to this. But on the other hand, impunity that comes with shoot at sight and rules like that is where the problem comes, right? There needs to be, instead, like we spoke about in education, a proper overhaul of how we look at conservation and poaching completely. Because the fact of the matter is, you can defend one against the other because there are enough reasons to do both. The problem is this aggressive approach that they've taken has actually done very little across the world to actually nixing the issue of poaching. So records of some years, like I said, showed that more humans were killed than rhinos themselves. And if it wasn't bad enough, this sort of militarized action also means that you unwittingly alienate your local populations that live around these parks. Without whose support, there is no way that you can actually put an end to poaching. So clearly, we need to be rethinking what conservation means and where we're going from, who is prioritized, what is prioritized, and yeah, just rethink.
On that note, we come to the end of this segment. We'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to Press Decode on the IVM Podcasts Network. Welcome back to Press Decode on the IVM Podcasts Network. It's time for our final segment this week, Roast or Toast.
I finally have a least fave item this week. The news cycle did not fail me. So you may or may not have heard about this story. I think if you were on Twitter, you definitely did. But earlier this week, Bobby, a sanitation worker in Mathura, found portraits of Modiji and Yogiji in the garbage. So he didn't really think much of it, put it in his cart and went on with his life. Except some angry men got personally offended about this act, which was deeply offensive, and took videos of the photos in the cart and accosted poor Bobby away. He was sacked for this crime. But then later, thanks to all the furore about the fact that, you know, this poor man was held responsible for something so bizarre, he did get his job back. But, like, if you actually read through the reports also say he had to unconditionally apologize and build his case as the sole breadwinner of his family before being reinstated. In the video, then later, after he got his job back, you know, I was listening to it. He makes a very valid point about how, if one were to look at it in hindsight, he would have been suspended either way. He said, "What if I did not take those images? Not that I thought much of it then. If I didn't clear out the trash, he would still suspend me saying I'm not doing my job."
Yeah.
So I don't really know what to make of this. Like, when I first saw it on Twitter, I didn't think it was an actual incident. And then it blew up. And hilariously, it started and finished for me on Twitter, because the most sane observation I actually saw was on that cursed app, as unreal as it may sound. Someone basically said, you know, if dumping photos of certain political personalities is a crime, then, like, from your newspapers, are you supposed to cut out all these images before throwing out newspapers? Like, where are we going to draw the line here? So I don't really know. It's clearly your least fave item, because we pretend like we have nothing better to do in life and get offended at really weak and bizarre things.
Yeah, but I have a fave item, which is also very ridiculous. It could have easily been a least fave, but no, I like this woman. Yeah, I'm going to tell you about this great American woman who thought it's a great idea to come to India, spend all her money, very nice for our economy, and fake her own abduction to get her family to send her money. So she ran out of money and she called her mom and said that she got beaten up and assaulted by some unknown guy, which is not true, by the way, and that they're holding her in some unsafe location. Now, she also contacted American Citizen Services by email. So what I mean, her parents obviously were flabbergasted. They contacted the US embassy in Delhi, and who tried to then, through the police, trace the IP address from where she sent the email. And that went back to some Nigerian man who then led the police to the woman who was basically just chilling in her, on her own in Greater Noida.
Of course it's Greater Noida.
Of course it's Greater Noida.
Yeah, chill hi karna tha. So you could have been that stay-at-home daughter, na? Like that American woman who spends 40 lakhs a day of her parents' money at her full-time job of being a stay-at-home daughter.
What? I'm sorry, what?
You remember this? You don't know this.
No.
There is some woman on the internet who says that she has a full-time job of being a stay-at-home daughter, and she spends 40 lakhs a day, and she says that looking pretty and doing whatever she does daily, spending this much money, is a job, is a full-time job for her. I don't know what she thinks a job means.
I don't know what part of this story has actually caught my attention. Greater Noida, this new aspirational job of stay-at-home daughter. I don't know what to take away. Vagda, you've confused me.
Take away what you want. You want to be stay-at-home daughter? Learn that. If you want to go somewhere and like fake your own abduction, that's also up to you, man. I'm just thinking that at this point, like, this section at least has just become like a space for shitting on Greater Noida. But can you blame us?
It's only valid and justified.
Correct. So I'm doing a complete U-turn. And this is my fave, just because I thought it was a delightful fact that people around the world use tombstones of their loved ones to pass on family recipes. And it's, I don't know, very innovative, I think. So these grave markers will have the usual text that says the normal things like in loving memory of so and so. And then either on the back or the side, or they'll have another stone next to the headstone. And that will give their recipe for, say, a peach cobbler or a fudge or a pie. And I mean, that's a great way to make sure your recipes never get lost. But someone called Rosie Grant on Instagram actually visits these graves and tries out some of these recipes. And it's very nice and wholesome, actually, because even though she's made a brand of going and visiting graves, she has built a community of people on TikTok and Instagram who give her tips and tricks to tweak the recipes to, you know, better suit, I don't know, like modern tastes or whatever. So again, very nice and wholesome with a touch of spookiness. If you think visiting graves is weird, that can be your takeaway also, but that is my weekly fact for this episode.
I'm surprised that you even have a fave, but maybe because of the touch of spookiness, yeah. it becomes like Prafulla category, you know.
But it's such nice item. I want to do this. I need to finalize a recipe.
That is great forethought, Sarah.
You have some time.
Here's hoping.
Okay, that was our show this week. Thank you so much for joining us on Press Decode. You can catch us every Thursday on the IVM Podcasts Network. And guys, please remember, don't let the news give you the blues.